hardball hitting with a baseball bat. Kick up your heels, kid, and leave them all flat. What does it mean to be American?
This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
What is it like to serve in a state legislature, be the Missouri Secretary of State, run for U.S. Senate, create a voting rights organization, and flirt with running for president? Jason Kander has seemingly done it all, with a particular focus on improving our election system and expanding the right to vote. He's the author of Outside the Wire, 10 Lessons I've Learned in Everyday Courage, and Invisible Storm, a soldier's memoir of politics and PTSD, which are both New York Times bestsellers and excellent reads. He's also the co-host of the podcast Majority 54 and the president of national expansion at the Veterans Community Project, which helps at-risk veterans. Jason, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thanks for having me. Good to see you.
So let's first talk about your journey into public service. What prompted you to run for office in the first place? It was state legislature, right? It was the first office. What prompted you to decide public service was a career path?
Well, I'd grown up in a very public service-oriented family. Nobody had really been in elected office, but my parents had been juvenile probation officers. My dad had been a police officer. And so like a lot of people, my grandpa and my great uncle had been in, World War II. And so in my mind, the idea of military service, which is where I started, was something that was sort of in the maybe someday category of my mind. And then 9/11 happened, and it went from maybe someday to I'm going to do this, and then I'll just make the rest of my life work around it. And so I joined the Army. I became an Army intelligence officer. I went to Afghanistan, and I had been inclined toward running for office already. I was thinking, in fact, that I was going to go home and I was probably going to run for the state legislature. But I think that it was my time in Afghanistan that really crystallized how I ended up seeing public service and how I ended up going about it. Because, you know, I grew up with a certain amount of privilege. There was no politician that was able to make a decision that would take food off my family's table or anything like that. And then to be in Afghanistan in 06, 07, and to have resources that we should have had that weren't there because they were in Iraq, it was the first time in my life that I had ever been on the receiving end of decisions that were made for political reasons and been negatively affected by them. And it's just something that I really kept with me throughout my time in public service.
Yeah, I love that answer because it is really what public service should be about, right? It's about doing good for others and you know, contributing to this project that we call America in a positive way. So after serving in the legislature, you then ran and won for Missouri Secretary of State, which of course has many roles, but also the chief elections officer. So why did you run for that office? And tell us a little bit about the elections aspect of serving as Missouri Secretary of State.
So, you know, I ran for that office back in 2012, which is only 12 years ago, but it feels in American politics like 100 years ago. And that's because back then, you know, when I was starting to run for it in 2011, issues like photo identification requirements, other voter suppression measures, they weren't at the front of the lexicon. They weren't at the front of the American mind. In fact, at that time, the vast majority of Democrats that you would poll would say that they supported a photo identification requirement to vote because people didn't really know much about the issue. It was just this thing that Republicans led by people like the Koch brothers had come up with to make it harder for folks who were less likely to vote Republican to be able to vote. So those of us who were, you know, people like you and me who were following this really closely knew that it was a weaponization of the electoral process. But the average voter didn't. And I saw that moment when there had been a Democrat in that office and it looked as Missouri was trending more red, that a Republican had a real opportunity to get that office. I felt the need to try and stand in the way. Ultimately that election, that campaign ended up largely being about photo identification requirements. And we sort of went on offense and were able to just barely win that race.
Yeah. And I want to talk about photo ID in Missouri in just a minute, but let me ask you, what was it like serving as the chief elections officer in a state that was trending red?
It was the first 2 years, I felt like we were on offense because our whole strategy was if we could stay on offense, we could keep a lot of the bad stuff from happening. And so the first 2 years, you know, we did things like we had a very creative way to get online voter registration done. The Republican-led state legislature did not want it, but we found Abe Rakove, my executive deputy secretary of state, who was not a lawyer, figured out that the law regarding signatures, like valid signatures in Missouri, said that an electronic signature had to be considered suitable. And it didn't need to be a so-called wet signature, like a handwritten signature. And so we took that and said, well, if an electronic signature is, if that's the law in Missouri, then that means that we could take the voter registration form, put it online. And even though we don't have voter registration online technically in the state, what we did is we created a system where people felt like it was because they filled out the form online, you know, signed the thing with their finger on an iPad or any kind of tablet. We printed off their application for voter registration in the Secretary of State's office and mailed it to their local jurisdiction. So the local jurisdiction ended up feeling like nothing changed for them. They got voter registration applications in the mail, like always, and voters had online voter registration. And we were able to do a lot of things like that. And it was very exciting to be able to make the process more accessible. And then I felt like, you know, I just served one term before I didn't run for re-election, ran for something else instead. And I felt like the second 2 years was spent trying to keep those things in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what's interesting about something like, you know, the online voter registration system that you mentioned, you know, the local registrars are still checking to make sure that these are real people, that they're eligible to vote. And so this should be something that would gain bipartisan support. And, you know, most places it has, but you still see the partisan divides. You also mentioned the wet signature issue, something that we're still facing in many states. You know, I think it's Georgia that is requiring a wet signature for absentee ballots, and that's going through litigation. So these fights, you know, were there in 2012 to 2016, and they're still ongoing. You know, you mentioned Missouri and photo ID, which is one of the first states to have a strict photo identification requirement. The state Supreme Court struck down its initial law in 2006 under the state constitution. But, you know, we see pushes to amend the state constitution, constant battles to impose strict photo ID laws. What can the lessons from Missouri about photo ID tell us nationwide on that issue?
I think the greatest lesson from Missouri is that it is important to be on offense. There's two lessons, I think. The first is that you cannot constantly be in a state of trying to explain all the time and educate all the time and be on defense, saying like, well, no, look, actually, we don't need this for this reason, that reason, et cetera. And pretending as though you take the other side on good faith, that they're really just trying to stamp out fraud. No, you have to go on offense and you have to make sure voters understand that they don't care about fraud, that they know that there's never been, for instance, in Missouri, a single case of voter impersonation fraud that photo ID would have done anything to stop. And so you have to go on offense and say, they're trying to keep you from voting. You have to make sure that you grab the reins of the debate rather than constantly being on defense. And the second is an extension of that, which is that you no longer, particularly with the change, the way the courts have changed, can rely on the idea that bad laws will get struck down in court. And that means that the debate has to expand, and I think this has happened largely in America, beyond the court of law and also into the court of public opinion, which is why after my time as Secretary of State, you know, we started Let America Vote, the whole concept of which I'm sure you're going to ask about, so we'll just segue into it, the whole concept of which was to create political consequences for voter suppression. Because the way it worked up until then was if a legislative body passes a law to make it harder to vote, probably the main sponsors are in very safe districts and the people who just went along voting with it, they're never punished for it because it wasn't an issue that really activated voters. And by the time it was clear that it had been a voter suppression law, it was a year and a half later, the court had struck it down. Nobody really remembered the debate in the first place. So Let America Vote was the first organization that said, okay, if you are a part of passing a voter suppression law, then we are going to flood volunteers and money into your district, and we are going to beat you, whether we end up having to talk about voter suppression to do it or not. I mean, we were a part of helping flip the Virginia state legislature after they tried to pass a voter suppression law. And some of the seats that were flipped were Let America Vote volunteers going door to door talking about traffic being a huge problem. But, you know, they showed up because they wanted to beat people on voter suppression. It didn't matter which issues they talked about. The idea was to get across to Republicans in vulnerable seats that you go with this voter suppression thing at your own peril. We will create a political consequence for it.
And of course, the issues that Let America Vote handles and focuses on are not partisan issues, or at least they shouldn't be, right? I mean, the point of this organization is not to be a partisan wing for or a partisan push for the Democratic Party, but to expand democracy overall, correct?
That's exactly right. Because the look, it happens to be the case that in the modern iteration of voter suppression, that it is almost exclusively the Republican Party that engages in it. But if you look over the history of the United States, if you look back to the Dixiecrat days, it hasn't been the sole province of the Republican Party. But at this moment, the way politics are lined up for the last 30 or so years, that's what it's been. And as a result, I mean, basically the theory of Let America Vote is that if you and also in Citizens United, the two have merged now, is that if you have an open process where money and politics doesn't totally corrupt the process and everybody who is eligible to vote gets the opportunity to vote, then you're going to have better behavior by both parties. You're going to have more people in the process. You're going to have things happen a little more. They're a little more likely to win on the merits as opposed to just because of raw political power.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing you said earlier about, you know, we have to go on offense reminds me of something I wrote in my first book, Vote for Us, about how we seem to be playing whack-a-mole. Right. You know, there's a voter suppression tactic that pops up and we try to fight it back and something else comes on the other side. And so, you know, the idea here is to engage in pro-voter mechanisms. It's not just about fighting voter suppression, but it's doing things like you mentioned on online voter registration. So tell us a little bit about the nuts and bolts. How do you create an organization like Let America Vote?
In my case, it really grew largely out of just a moment of opportunity. I mean, it was, you know, I had run this race for U.S. Senate that had been very close in Missouri in 2016 and come very close to winning. And also in the process had, you know, done some things that went viral and so had a pretty high profile in 2017. And it was sort of an opportunity to try and do something positive with that platform that I had ended up with. And so as a result, took, you know, donor lists and volunteer lists and turned them into Let America Vote. And it was also a moment where it was after a presidential election that a lot of progressives, all progressives felt had gone tragically, right? And it was like, 4 years until the next one, and it was 2 years until a midterm, and people were really hungry for the opportunity to get in and start working. And so all those things came together, and it created a pretty robust organization.
Yeah, now you had a pretty big profile, as you mentioned. You were encouraged to run for president. Even Barack Obama floated your name. I understand you talked about this a lot in terms of whether you thought you would throw your name into the ring. Instead, opted to run for Kansas City mayor. But as you've written about extensively, you dropped out of the race, talking about your PTSD from your time serving in the Middle East. And now you're very open about mental health issues, which is so important. Tell us a little bit more about why discussing mental health. Tell us a little bit more about why discussing mental health, especially in today's political environment, is so important.
You know, I think for me, what I learned in that process is just to go back in time a little. You know, I was planning to run for president, like you said, and then behind the scenes, my mental health was getting worse and worse because I had not acknowledged or treated the PTSD that I had sustained serving in Afghanistan. And now we're talking about a decade had gone by and it just had been getting worse and worse and worse. So I had this idea that if I go home and I run for mayor and I get to be mayor of my hometown, then maybe that will make me feel whole and sort of fix things. And of course, you know, that campaign was going very well. If you go from running for president to running for mayor of your hometown, you really ought to be the front runner. And I was, but personally, I was just getting worse and worse, and it should have been a lot of fun. I mean, running for mayor of your hometown when you are pretty much extremely likely to win should be a very fun thing to do. And I was not having any fun because I was just going downhill. And so ultimately, I made that decision that I was going to step back and I was going to go get help for PTSD at the VA. And then I was presented with a decision that is at the crux of your question, which was, you know, there was an opportunity to just sort of come up with some other reason as to why I was stepping back from everything. But ultimately, I decided to be public about it for two reasons, kind of equally in weight. One was that I had been concealing from myself to some degree, but certainly from the world, all these symptoms that I'd been having for years. And that weighed on me as well. And I felt strongly that if I was going to have a chance to get better, I needed to live very openly. And I didn't want to have to conceal any of this. I just wanted to be myself. And then the other half of it was that I felt a real, at that time I figured, well, I'm going to do this and people will be like, okay, bye. We have no interest in hearing from you again. But I thought maybe on my way out, I could help somebody who was in the position that I had been in. And it, as it turned out, through speaking about it and the announcement initially and writing the book, that has really come to fruition. I've had the great opportunity to hear from hundreds, if not thousands, of people who it sort of, not just veterans, but all sorts of people who it sort of gave them the permission slip they needed to go get help.
Yeah, that's great. And it's such an important thing to be able to help people. And if you can, be open about it. And that feeds into your current work with the Veterans Community Project, this nonprofit organization that serves homeless and at-risk veterans. But this is a show about democracy, so I'm wondering if you can tell us how those services to veterans are part of the larger picture of democracy in America.
Well, you know, I guess I would just say that to me, there's a continuum. You know, when you think about the people who have fought to protect democracy from external forces, and right now I think we have plenty of internal forces as well that are after it. But as far as people who have fought to protect it from without, if you aren't a country that actually takes care of those people afterwards and recognizes that there's a consequence to engaging in war, then it's pretty hard to keep the faith with your democracy as well. And so I do see a consistent thread between the two. And look, it's the best civilian job I've ever had. I mean, it's unlike politics. I never really have a question as to whether what I'm doing is making a difference because I get to see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. So there's a lot of doom and gloom out there about American democracy. This show is called Democracy Optimist. Are you optimistic about voting in elections in 2024?
I would say that I am cautiously optimistic. And I'm very concerned about what the results of this election will be. But when I look at the rising generation of Americans and when I talk to them, whether they are Republicans or Democrats, when I think about their actual views on democracy and extremism, and you know, now I'm old enough, I can say younger Americans. When I talk to younger Americans, it does fill me with a lot of optimism and it does make me feel like we're going to be okay.
Yeah, that I think I agree with you, right? The young generation, of course, I'm teaching law students, majority of which are in their mid-20s, and they come from all different political persuasions, but I have that same sense as you. But that leads me to my next question. Why should people vote? What's the point, especially, you know, when it's going to be a handful of swing states that decides the presidential election?
You know, the easiest thing I can say is that the reason people should vote is because it's really the only, we don't really ask that much of our citizens. I mean, at the end of the day, it's just, there's maybe an element of me that, wants to just say, hey, it's not that hard to do, like, particularly if you're not the target of voter suppression. And also the fact that voter suppression exists and people don't want you to vote, that should motivate you to vote. That should motivate you to say, no, I'm not going to allow you to do that. But usually when I think about this question of why people should vote, it's usually tied to the question of why people don't. And I try to remind particularly elected officials that, because you'll sometimes hear elected officials complain about low turnout. And I try to remind everybody that low turnout is a vote. It is people saying, you have not proven to me that this process is worth my time. It is people rendering a verdict on the process. And so I think when we think about why people should vote, we've also got to be very mindful of the fact that anybody in a position of public trust has to think every day about giving people a motivation to vote and making sure they feel that it's a worthwhile use of their time.
Jason Kander is the author of two books and the co-host of a podcast called Majority 54. Jason, thanks for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Josh, Jason Kander is a veteran, works with veterans, so let's explore something. What are the voting rules for people serving in the military?
Yeah, such an important topic because these people obviously serve our country. We should ensure that they have the ability to vote. About three quarters of the 1.3 million active duty military members are eligible to vote absentee with special protections because they're stationed away from their voting residence, according to the Federal Voting Assistance Program. There are two laws that impact military voting: the Uniformed and Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act, sometimes known as UOCAVA, and the Military and Overseas Voter Empowerment Act, or MOVE Act, which amended UOCAVA in 2009. Under these laws, members of the military and their families, as well as overseas citizens, have various protections. States must transmit their ballots at least 45 days before a federal election and offer at least one method of electronic submission, such as email, fax, or an online portal. The 45-day deadline is important. It means that states must have their ballots complete by mid-September for the November election. Although not perfect, the requirement has certainly helped. Prior to the 2009 MOVE Act, 30% of military voters reported that they did not receive their ballot in time or at all, but that number was reduced to 15% of military voters in 2022. Of course, our election administrators should work to reduce that number to zero so that everyone serving in the military has an easy ability to vote.
As a society, we're getting better about openly talking about mental health issues. And I guess this really shouldn't be surprising given the way campaign rhetoric can mess with our minds, but is it established that elections actually do affect our mental health?
Well, some psychiatrists think so. You know, Jason Kander told us that mental health is an issue that's important to discuss openly, and what psychiatrists refer to as election stress disorder. Now, that's not a scientific diagnosis, but they say that it is a real concept. The Mayo Clinic says that 68% of adults reported a rise in anxiety due to the 2020 election, which was up from 41% who reported anxiety from the 2016 election. Voters of color in particular reported increased anxiety from 46% in 2016 to 71% in 2020, stemming from the election. But some studies also show that voting and civic engagement are correlated with improved mental health outlooks. One study found that young adults who vote experience less depression, and researchers hypothesize that voting can help individuals with mental illness feel more connected to their communities. Of course, mental health is a complicated issue. As one psychiatrist wrote, quote, "Presidential elections can cause large amounts of anxiety as a country, but voting can also lower your depression and help you feel connected. This makes it important to engage in politics healthily." And if you are experiencing any issues with mental health, please make sure to reach out to trusted sources to seek help. You are not alone.
What's something we can do to support democracy for veterans?
The Department of Veterans Affairs has great resources for veterans in helping them register to vote and cast a ballot. You can visit va.gov/initiatives/vote to learn more about the resources available to veterans who so bravely served for our country and deserve easy access to the ballot. Again, that's va.gov/initiatives/vote. What does it mean to be American? Home of the free. Ooh. And the true. What does it mean? Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm Tom Martin, your series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Democracy Optimist is a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions for Richmond, Kentucky-based public radio station WEKU.